So first of all, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to apologize for giving this talk on PowerPoint, not on a blackboard. And the only excuse I have is that it's not actually a talk on theoretical physics. The idea was that since we have in this program a combination of several communities to give kind of introduction of what each group is more or less thinking about now, and I'm not sure I will be able to actually present any community, because really situation is not very well stabilized in this field yet, at least to my point of view. But at least I can try to explain the way I see the situation, and that's why I hope you will excuse if I will be really colloquial and not pay too much attention on exact reference and things like that. So actually, when talking with people from older generation who used to speak with Landau, I realized that the reason why Landau himself never wanted to write a volume about physical kinetics was that it was against the main principle of his course. Because every volume that he wrote was kind of basic idea, and then you develop this idea and apply it to certain particular situations, but there should be a core like Lagrange principle or Gibbs distribution, and then you develop what is going on. And he actually could not see anything in kinetics that would serve as this basic idea, and that's why he really resisted on writing the story. And I have to admit that when we add quantum component to that, when we start to think about problems which by no means can be described in terms of semi-classical Boltzmann-like equation, then situation becomes even more mosaic, and you have to really separate topics and try to understand what is going on in a particular situation. So this is basically what I will try to do today. So in order to start with, let me kind of in parallel speak about two different types of quantum phenomena, which are not very different, as we will see, but at the same time, different groups, even in our program, would prefer either thinking in terms of quantum spin or thinking in terms of quantum particle like an electron. So let's start with spin. If we have spin 1/2, it is described by a spinor, two-component wave function, and there is a phase phi, non-trivial phase between phase difference between these two components. And if you are interested in the expectation values of the components of your spin, then they can be presented through this psi up, psi down, and phi. And it's still not fit.
That's side down, because we side down squared.
Excuse me?
Side down is actually side down squared. In the expression for C, it's a square.
Okay. So what I want to tell is that there are different quantum games that you can play with this system, and I by no means want to teach you quantum mechanics. Just remind that if you, for instance, start with the spin which is directed in x direction and apply magnetic field in the direction and wait for time delta t, then there will be some rotation due to this magnetic field, and as a result there will be oscillations. If you, for instance, make a setup that will make measure x component of your spin, then you will observe oscillations of this x component. Now you can play a slightly more sophisticated game. You can apply spin which is magnetic field which is parallel to your spin, get Zeeman splitting, and then apply also AC field which will make transitions between spin up and spin down, and as a result you will get this Rabi oscillation. But what we are going to discuss today is what happens when your spin is interacting with some environment, some external degrees of freedom, and as a result there is something which is out of our control. For instance, there is some random time-dependent magnetic field which changes phase phi in uncontrollable way, and it's the same as to tell that it rotates the spin, and this phenomena can be called decoherence. Well, yeah?
Your title says dephasing and decoherence. Are they essential? Can they, these terms be used interchangeably?
Well, you see, definitions is something not to argue about. I can propose you something, and this is what I'm going to do in a short while. But in literature, in NMR literature, and in a more recent works on qubits, people would call decoherence, and I will even try to be a little bit more precise in telling what actually people call decoherence. But if you recall literature about nuclear magnetic resonance or any other magnetic resonance, there will be always this relaxations time T1 and T2 that are connected with this decoherence caused by the environment.
But should I be thinking this field is as a quantum mechanical fluctuating B field, or just a classical thermally driven one? I guess what I'm really asking is, what physical is this supposed to be addressing a real physical situation, or is this just a toy model that you want to study?
No, this is very toy model, and we will speak about physical situation a little bit later.
Okay.
But because I definitely don't want to give a talk on NMR, I'm not at all an expert. But yes, you can start thinking even about decoherence by some classical, not quantum field, and it is one of the reasons how decoherence appears. Yeah?
A classical quantum field will nevertheless leave the spin definitely pointing in some direction. Yeah. If any time-dependent magnetic field that I find will leave the spin in some definite pure state pointing in some direction.
If you make one measurement, so you did something with your spin and then measured Z component, it will be either up or down. But this is the not the measurement that people are doing, and actually I will demonstrate it in a couple of minutes. What people usually do, and what people are going to do in all kind of quantum computer project is statistical measurement. So they plan to make these measurements many times and ask themselves what is the probability to get spin up and what is the probability to get down. So I really apologize. I thought everything was fixed, but it's still shifted to the left. So this is one of the probably the first paper where people realized this NMR game in solid state implementation. It is based on so-called Cooper pair box, and it was done by Nakamura, Pashkin, and Tsai in at NEC in Japan. So what you have a superconducting grain, which is in this literature called Cooper pair box, and you apply in this experiment short voltage pulse, and as a result you get quantum superposition of two charged states of this superconducting grain, which is in some contact with the large bulk superconducting reservoir. So with some probability you have charge Q, and with other probability you have charge Q plus 2E, and there is interference between these two. And then the tunneling current through the probe junction is determined by which state you are in. So it's not as complicated as it looks here. Let's see again, there is this Cooper pair box, as I told, just small piece of superconductor, which is connected via Josephson junctions with bulk superconductor. There is also this element which is called gate, and this element allows to change the voltage on this Cooper pair box and favor certain charge state. And there is probe junction that allows extra charge to tunnel, and you can measure the current that is a result of this tunnel. So just to remind, it is more or less another implementation of this current through quantum dot. And what we need to remember is that if you have this gate electrode as a function of gate voltage, you can get either situation when a system definitely prefers certain charge state, when a minimum of energy corresponds to integer charge, and then you have so-called valley of Coulomb blockade. Conductance in this state is very low because system is happy with n electrons and doesn't want to change it by to n plus one or n minus one. Or you can get in a state where energies with n and n plus one electrons are the same, and then it is much easier to start, say, with n electrons, add one more, get n plus one, then take it away on the other side of the quantum dot, and keep doing this, carrying current through this system. And this situation is called peak of Coulomb blockade, because you have peak of the conductance. And the only thing that we have to modify in this picture, when this quantum dot is superconducting and superconducting gap is very large, is to substitute charge E by 2E, because we don't allow single electrons, only pairs here, and this is the same situation. So what these authors proposed to do was to start with a state which was in the valley of the Coulomb blockade, and that's why there is no current at all. And then they applied a pulse, you see this pulse, that for some pulse of gate voltage, that for some time will drive the system into the peak of the Coulomb blockade, where this original state is not eigenstate, but rather some linear combination of state with zero charge and charge 2 in this Cooper pair box. So this pulse has certain time delta t. You keep it in this state, As a result, this linear combination acquires certain phase, and then you the pulse finishes and your system goes back either to the same state with zero charge or to the state with charge 2. And if it ended up with charge 2, then there will be current through the probe junction, and this current you can detect.
I'm sorry, what are you varying to go between the valley state and the peak state? You're varying the gate voltage?
This amplitude of the peak should be exactly big enough to drive your system from this valley to the peak state.
So what's the horizontal axis in that picture?
This axis, I'm sorry, this is actually gate voltage. So Q divided by E is just a definition that accepted in this. QT is basically gate voltage times.
And the two curves are the energy for zero choice.
Mm-hmm. So you have this Josephson coupling. As a result, in your Hamiltonian, there is coupling between charge 0 and charge 2. When you are in the valley of the Coulomb blockade, charge 0 has very low energy, charge 2 has high energy, so this coupling is negligible. However, if you get into the peak of the Coulomb blockade, then without Josephson coupling, it would be degeneracy, and Josephson coupling just splits this degeneracy. And this splitting of this degeneracy is the reason why when you keep your system there will be phase difference generated. And then you measure extra current. Extra means the current that was caused by the pulse. And there is this oscillation as function of Q0, which is basically original position of your system. But what we actually want to do, we want to measure this extra current as function of length of this pulse, delta t. And I want to emphasize that measurement that was done here and is done in all this experiment is not single pulse. It's always pulse array. They use like million of these pulses repeating this experiment again and again. And the result that they present is result of averaging over many measurements. And so what you see as a function of delta t are these oscillations, and period of these oscillations is, of course, determined by this energy splitting, which is Josephson junction. And these oscillations look like the clear manifestation of quantum interference. Now, just to finish with this type of experiment, this is something more interesting and more close to what people actually want. And, yeah?
Sorry, on the previous slide, the oscillations don't look very sinusoidal to
me. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. No, of course, there is a lot of noise and things like that. Actually, when experiment is refined, these oscillations look more and more sinusoidal. What is, and you will see it in a second, what is more worrisome is the fact that the amplitude of these oscillations is not as high as we would like to, and I will speak about that. But the shape, it's just first experiment, I think. They were not really worried about
that.
In this particular,
yes.
Let me speak. I mean, I have a whole story about that, so I promise. And one of the reasons why it might be not sinusoidal but more complicated is that your pulse is not really box at all, because it's actually really big. If there is big experimental achievement, is how people now manage to manipulate with these high frequency signals in these nanostructures. It's really huge progress in the last few years. Okay, so the reason why I want to show it, first of all, it gives me opportunity to show a little bit more beautiful pictures. But second is that this is something which you already cannot do as easily with NMR spins, because now you have what they called two coupled qubits. So what you have two Cooper pair boxes, you have separate gates that can be can change gate voltages on these Cooper pair boxes, and as a result, you now have to characterize your system by not by charge in the Cooper pair box, but by two charges, charge in one box and charge in another box. And if you will draw a stability diagram in this plane, you will find that if you just go along one gate voltage, you can change charge in one box, and it would be one qubit operating and another being a spectator. Or if you go and change gate voltage in a different a box, you will change charge of second qubit. But what you also can do, if you are lucky, you can shoot exactly to this X point, where both things are unstable, and then you will get a linear combination of states which have different charges at these two different Cooper pair boxes. And then in this four level systems, here you have this again, this degeneracy without Josephson junction, Josephson coupling, and then you can study the oscillations of the current. So what they observed was this is simply a repetition of the previous experiment with one and with the second Cooper pair box. When you shoot either in point L or point R, and this is what happens when you shoot to point X.
So at point X, the superposition is between a state where the electron is in the right-hand box and where the electron is in the left-hand box.
Yeah, and both.
Okay, from your picture, it looked like you only had a degeneracy between 0, 1, and 1, 0,
mm-hmm.
but not between 1, 1, and 0, 0, or...
No, so...
It looks like, is that supposed to be a little line segment?
There? Yeah, there is little line. Right.
So, yeah. There's only degeneracy between mm-hmm. 0, 1, and 1, 0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Well, the measurement process, it doesn't disturb what's going on.
This is a good question, and now they're working on something much more sophisticated. Right now, what you will look for is after you made this manipulation, either if you get into this state, you will have current through one. If you get in this state, you will get current through second. But at least before you shoot, you always stay in a valley for both Cooper pair boxes, so there is no current going on. I mean, unfortunately, I don't have time to speak about readout, but at least I don't think readout here is a problem. So,
are you asking whether or not this data is collected, you know, in one run? Or are you asking, you know, these points?
No. It's really a good question, because what you need to do after you created your quantum state,
yes.
you have to measure it.
Yes.
And the question is how you actually measure this quantum state.
But each point is collected in a different run, waiting for a longer time.
Now, each point is result of averaging of many shots.
Yes.
Because every shot creates a charge 2E, either here or here, or maybe in both. But
you're not actually observing the oscillations in real time. Exactly. You're running it many, many, many times.
Yeah. Of course. Because this is not real time. This is actually this is length of the pulse.
Yeah. That raises a question. You said the pulses are actually arrays. Are the spacings between time delays between the pulses much longer than
much
the
longer? Much longer. So if you follow these results, you get some exponential decay of the amplitude of these oscillations with 2.5 nanoseconds here. And if you will look on these oscillations when these two qubits or two pseudospins are coupled, then you get 0.6. This decoherence times, it's about one quarter. And this is again something which I don't think completely clear why one quarter, why these times are not the same or factor two. Why this decay increases so. But at least if you make experiments like this, you can call decoherence time this decay of the amplitude of this oscillation. Okay, now let me for a short while completely change gears, Premi. Now I'm starting to speak about a different thing, at least the way how I understand it. I will try to introduce this notion of defacing. So I try to understand at least in the same way as it's done in interference experiments in optics. So you start with your system in a pure quantum state, which is characterized by certain wave functions function with certain phase, and then you make some perturbation which derives your system to another quantum state, and the amplitude of this transition also has the amplitude and the phase. And then what you want to do, you want to compare the phase of this amplitude with the phase of another amplitude of the same transition. So basically, it is the same story as you have in Fabry-Perot interferometer when you use a beam splitter and then study interference between these two beams, and this interference will tell you what happened with each of the beams on their way to this point where they are going to interfere. Now, about defacing. So if you don't control all the perturbations and there is some random component, then what you will get some random contribution to the phase, delta phi. This delta phi depends on the time of the experiment. And then as soon as this uncontrolled random part of the phase exceeds 2 pi, you basically completely average out your interference, and that's why you can determine this time tau phi, defacing time, as time at which this delta phi became of the order of 2 pi, and you can call it defacing or phase coherence time, and its inverse will be defacing rate. So it's as simple as that, and if we agree with this definition, let me explain why I think this definition is important. So imagine that I'm doing the following Gedanken experiment. Suppose I have some particle or quantum system that interacts with environment and can exchange energy with environment. And let typical energy transfer between our system and environment be delta epsilon, and of course it depends on time we give for this interaction. Then if we want to if we want to measure the energy of our system, we have a kind of conflict of interest, because if we are measuring it too quickly, we will have usual quantum mechanical uncertainty. If we're measuring it for too long time, then everything will be smeared out by the interaction with the environment. So there are two terms in the total uncertainty. One is environment, another is quantum. And then you realize that one of them tends to infinity when t goes to infinity, another tends to infinity when t goes to zero. So there is probably a certain optimal time of measurement to minimize the total uncertainty. And probably this optimal time is determined by the condition that these two terms are of the same order. If you write down this condition, you will immediately realize that this condition is the same condition as delta phi of order unity. So this t star, this optimal time, is actually our dephasing time. And moreover, this minimal uncertainty that you can reach in principle is actually also of the order of inverse dephasing time. Yeah? No. I mean, we agreed that it is, suppose everything in the measurement is perfect. This all, you know, principle restrictions. You cannot make uncertainty smaller than this, and you cannot make it smaller than this. No, you can get more, but not less. I mean, if you, but, yeah. So the conclusion is that this dephasing time is also the minimal resolution of the energy that we can reach in principle, and that's why its physical significance is clear. Now, the question is, how can you measure it in real systems? And now I'm going to switch from spins for a while to electrons. And in electronic systems, nature actually created something like Fabry-Pérot interferometers all the time. And there are two phenomena which I will briefly mention, which allow to measure this dephasing time directly, which is weak localization and mesoscopic fluctuation. There is another phenomenon called persistent current, and for persistent current as well as for all things connected with orthogonality catastrophe, I hope I will have some time to discuss why you cannot measure dephasing using these measurements, provided I will have time for this discussion. So, weak localization. What you have, if you measure conductance of electrons in some disordered system so that these electrons can scatter by some quench disorder, and as a result they diffuse and can come back to the same point, then what you can realize is that the phase generated on the way clockwise and counterclockwise is the same, provided T invariance is not violated. And this phase is directly connected with magnetic flux through this loop, so that it can be fine-tuned with magnetic field. And as a result, if you change magnetic field, you change probability for quantum particles to come back, and as a result, you change your resistance. And this is more or less how it looks in a real experiment. You just measure resistance as function of magnetic field at different temperatures, and you see this very specific, here it is, minima of the resistance. In some system it's maxima, but dependence is very specific, and the sharpness of this singularity of resistance as function of magnetic field is determined by this dephasing time and dephasing length straightforwardly. So by measuring magnetic resistance, you can quantitatively determine lengths at which you violate phase coherence and this phase coherence time. Now, slightly different phenomena is known as mesoscopic fluctuations. And here, you don't need even to come back to the same point. You just have interference between amplitudes of getting from any point to any other point, from any point A to any point B. And again, this phase is random, determined by the random potential. But when you apply magnetic field, you get the phase, extra phase due to the magnetic field, which is determined only by the area of the loop. And that's why studying the amplitude of this so-called magnetic fingerprints and making proper statistical analysis, you can also extract dephasing time. So these are two measurements which I hope you will agree with me are very much like Fabry-Perot interferometer. Now the question is, can you reliably extract dephasing rate from these measurements, or in other words, this dephasing that you will observe by these measurements, is it always only due to inelastic processes, or there are other means of smearing this singularity? And here we actually face a problem, because everything that violates the invariance will actually affect weak localization. For instance, if you somehow created a random magnetic field, even if it is quenched, your weak localization singularity will be smeared, and you cannot distinguish it from a real breaking of phase coherence. And at the same time, when you go to measuring mesoscopic fluctuations, even if somewhere inside there is a quenched magnetic field, nothing actually changes, because you still can apply your external magnetic field and keep measuring everything. And the amplitude of these fingerprints, amplitude of these random oscillations of conductance as function of magnetic field will not be will not vanish because of this quenched magnetic field. The worst that will happen is that you will get it will get reduced by factor 2. So still, you can distinguish T invariance violation from real dephasing by measuring mesoscopic fluctuations. So it looks like we are safe. We just measure mesoscopic fluctuations, make statistical analysis, and extract real dephasing rate. But there is opposite problem. And people who are doing glasses will realize how severe it is. So let us imagine now that there is some very slow dynamics going on in this random system. So for instance, every once in a while your impurity moves or something like this happens. Then if this happens at the time much longer than it takes electron to go around this loop, weak localization will be not affected, and for any loop at any time these two phases will coincide, and that's why weak localization will not be affected. At the same time, this phase difference between two trajectories that take us from point A to point B, of course, will be time dependent, because if we measure at times comparable with the time at which disorder changes, then we will feel it as change of the phase difference, and this averaging will smear the mesoscopic fluctuation. So as a result, weak localization effects do not feel any motion of impurities, and mesoscopic fluctuations get suppressed. So mesoscopic fluctuations are immune against violation of t-invariance, but at the same time, they feel slow dynamics much stronger than weak localization. So in a sense, what you can tell is that in weak localization, what we are doing quick averaging over different realizations of the disorder, while in mesoscopic fluctuations, we do not average over the disorder, but we have to average over time. And if we don't average over anything, we cannot distinguish this from the noise. And this is impossible to make any conclusive statements by this measurement without averaging. Okay, and the last remark now about this type of measuring of dephasing is what happens if you have magnetic impurities in your system. If you are at large enough temperature so that your magnetic impurities are free to flip, then you clearly will suppress both weak localization and mesoscopic fluctuations. For instance, for weak localization, it's clear that if you, by going clockwise, flipped one impurity from up to down and then second impurity from down to up, you cannot do it moving with the same spin moving in opposite direction. So indeed, at large temperatures, there is some dynamics and it will cause some dephasing. When temperature goes to zero, magnetic impurities have two possibilities. Either if they are very dilute, you have contour scattering and then they are completely screened, or if concentration is high enough, there will be a substantial RKKY interaction, and as a result, they will form something like a spin glass. So it looks like there will be no elastic dephasing, no dephasing without energy transfer. But again, if you have a glassy state of this magnetic impurity system, you probably have some long time spin dynamics, and at the same time, you have some kind of quench magnetic field. So this is something to think about, and maybe even some alternative way to study dynamics, slow dynamics of glasses by making this type of measurement. Okay, so then let me switch back to spin now, because what I want to demonstrate that in spin systems you more or less have the same problem, and the same controversy between violating of t invariance and slow dynamics. So what you can do in this qubits, as well as with NMR spin, you can try to make more sophisticated measurement than we discussed some time ago, and measure echo situation. So the idea is to eliminate inhomogeneity effects and get rid of low frequency long time dynamics. So what you can do, maybe I will better look show you here. What you can do is you apply not one pulse but three pulses, and because of this second pulse, what you are doing, you are flipping your spin completely and cause it then moving in the same magnetic field in the opposite direction, and then everything that was uncertain in the first half of the evolution will be cancelled by the second half. So if you are just studying effect of one pulse, which is called as free induction decay, you can see that your dynamics is developed on the scale of picoseconds, and the same will be as a function of this length of the second pulse. But if you will go and measure oscillations as function of this TD distance between first pulse and second pulse, you see that your relaxation happens at much longer times, which are few nanoseconds. And this is something that I want to go through in a little bit more of detail. So what I'm measuring is a ratio of the current through the probe junction at time tau, and the same current immediately when tau equals to zero. And this ratio can be written as through this decoherence factor D as some exponential dependence. So now let's assume that this distance between the two levels, delta E, is slightly fluctuating. So as a function of time, this distance between two levels changes slightly as compared with its average value. Then there will be extra phase generated that can be presented as an integral of this energy difference. And this decay will be just average e to the I phi, because remember that we are measuring result of many shots, not just one of them. Now, if you assume that this correlation function is Gaussian, with that this noise is Gaussian with certain correlation function S, what you will get is that your decoherence factor will be presented as integral of this correlation function with convoluted with some combination of sinuses and omegas. And what is important that this this factor tends to constant when omega goes to zero. And the lower limit of this integral is just inverse time of the measurement. Now, this is correct for usual experiment for free induction decay. Now, if you make echo measurement, what you get almost the same combination. It's 4, not 2, which is not as important. But what is really important is the fact that sinus is now squared. And as a result, when omega goes to zero, this factor is not constant anymore, but vanishes as omega squared. So in echo experiment, the fluctuations with low frequency are strongly suppressed, and they are not important, while at for free induction decay, they are indeed important. And if you will, for instance, assume that you have 1 over F noise, so that this correlation function is inverse proportional to omega, what you will get for free induction decay this logarithm of a ratio between length of your pulse and total time of your measurement, and this logarithm should be taken with some respect, because this ratio can be as large as 10 to the 9 in a real experiment, and that's why decay for free induction experiment and for echo experiment are so different. And indeed, what they measured was this was decay for free induction, and these points are what they measured for echo signal. And you can see that this is still much quicker decay than what you will get assuming that it is a simple inelastic interaction with the environment, which I don't want to go into details, but you can calculate pretty reliably. Now, there is still a little bit more that you can tell about this situation. But let's first try repeat again. How happened that a very slow change of the energy splitting, much slower than inverse time of the signal of the pulse, how happened that this thing caused some decoherence? And the answer is that this is not true dephasing. It's a kind of temporarily inhomogeneous broadening. Each time when you shoot, you get a signal which is not decaying, but the frequencies of these signals after each shot are slightly different. You shoot once, you get oscillations with some frequency. You shoot second time, frequency is a little bit less. Next time, it's a little bit more. When you average, you get this suppression. And this is why echo helps. It helps exactly in the same way as measuring average weak localization effect helps to get rid of slow fluctuations of the random potential. Now, what you can do, you can actually even invent another term for that. People who are doing this type of experiments would rather call it not dephasing, they will call it gate error, because what actually happens is that effect is very similar to having simply your pulse fluctuating in amplitude. Even a very small fluctuation of your operating of the amplitude of your operating pulse will already mimic some dephasing. Now, a few words about 1 over F noise, because it's kind of a funny story. First, let me remind how you actually get 1 over F noise. The simplest picture is that somewhere nearby, you have a kind of two-level system. And each two-level system, each fluctuator can be in one of two states. It can be completely classical one. And it creates certain dipole moment. And as a result, certain electric field that acts on your system. And if it is just one fluctuator, it will be characterized by some relaxation rate gamma, and correlation function which you get from this exponential decay will be just Lorentz. Now, if you have several fluctuators with different relaxation times, then you will get signal which is sum over all fluctuations. And if you will assume that these couplings are statistically independent of relaxation times, and that logarithm of relaxation times are uniformly distributed, which is kind of natural to assume if this relaxation time is exponent of something uniformly distributed, then
distributed over some finite range.
Yeah, but this range can be very large. Then, as a result just of this integration, you get 1 over omega signal. Now, why I'm telling this story to you? Because actually, I don't believe that in a nanostructure you can have too many fluctuators that affect this small thing. Because this coupling actually decays with distance pretty quickly, usually as cube of the distance. And for this reason, what happens is that you have either one or couple of fluctuators that are mostly strongly coupled with your system. Now, if you have only one single fluctuator, then the coherence factor will be not tau square, but it will change. It will be tau to the cube when tau is small, and this behavior will change to linear one when tau is large. So it also means that actually at different time scales you can have different fluctuators that are important. So the picture will be more or less like this if you will plot ratio between decoherence time and the divided by tau, then what you get by from one fluctuator is something like this as compared with linear dependence due to 1 over F noise. But what you have to take into account is that at different time intervals you can have different fluctuators involved, and that's why your dependence should be some kind of non-monotonic and random depending on particular realization of these fluctuators. And that's why I think maybe this singularity that they observed is not just some noise, but rather the switching from one single fluctuator to another. At least if they will have it, it will look more or less like that. Okay, so coming back to this story, I don't think that in this two-coupled qubits you have anything more than that. It's not inelastic defacing. I think it's more or less the same low frequency noise that causes this this decoherence. And we have not finished this simple calculation, but I think that it's not impossible to get this 1/4. Yeah?
I mean, is fluctuators, is it an electron, some trapped
state? Well, it's difficult to tell. So I think what you have in these structures when you have substrate and then oxide and things like that, you always have some oxide and some insulating layers. In the insulator, it's easy to imagine that you have traps that can either trap a charge or have two states which are almost the same energy and allow some switching there.
When you think about telegraph noise, you're thinking of that as classical thermally hopping of the battery, right? Nothing quantum mechanical in that.
No. This is exactly quantum mechanical story. I don't think, exactly classical story. I don't think that these fluctuators should be treated in a quantum way. Also, well, I don't think it's possible. For instance, there can be some slow dynamics in a glue that you use to glue your system to the substrate. I mean, usually people use a lot of tricks to get rid of that. For instance, they have special layer, a special metallic layer, trying to screen themselves from this background charge fluctuation. It's more like, you know, an art. Different crystal growers give material which is very different on the level of noise, and nobody knows what actually controls that. It's almost on the level of, you know, gourmet cooking.
These fluctuations are of the glue, for example, are or are not in equilibrium. Shouldn't that play? Because suppose they are, so these are two-level systems that are just in equilibrium with the thermal bar, then there would be some reaction to the presence of the electrons, the two electrons, or the spin you're using. In the other case, they are very high excitations, which are just decaying, and then nothing can stop them.
No, I'm not sure I got your question correctly, but I talked with many people who face these problems, trying to understand what it actually depends on. And for instance, this is result of measurements which you keep your sample in the millikelvin region for several days. I mean, what will be if they will keep it for a year in millikelvin? I don't know, but measuring it 2 hours after cooling or 2 days after cooling makes almost no difference. This is what I've heard from them. On the other hand, again, it's not that really systematic studies of the time of how long it happened after cooling actually. Okay, so what I want to tell, and this is also interesting to think about, is that their readout, in fact, was very primitive. So what they would not, because they have many shots, they wouldn't distinguish between transition from the 0, 0 to 0 to 1, 0, and then another transition from 0, 0 to 0, 1, and one transition from 0, 0 to 1, 1. So it's not full quantum measurement. But in fact, it is possible to make in this system full quantum measurement. You can really tell what was the probability to get this state, what was the probability to get this state, and what was the probability to get this state, even with their phase. And I think sooner or later people will learn how to do that. Now, just a few more comments. I mean, I have still some time. So, what else is actually dangerous in speaking about these oscillations as about quantum phenomena? So, in fact, if you will take spin 1/2, put it into magnetic field, it will rotate. If you will take iron nail, put it in magnetic field, it will rotate too. So the fact of the rotation itself is not at all a guarantee of any quantum nature. So if you have spin 1/2, you have two states. If you have larger spins, you have more states. But in all of these cases, you will still have spin rotation. In the very classical limit, you will have something very similar to harmonic oscillation in magnetic field. Infinitely large spin gives you many equidistant states, and there will be just the same type of the oscillations. Now, if you want to make any kind of quantum computation, at least what people have in mind right now, there is no compromise. You should have spin 1/2. You should have two-level system. And you cannot involve highly excited states, which are clearly involved if you are making this type of experiment.
Why only two-level?
Because all the algorithms,
they're
based on that. If you will allow transitions to highly excited state from the point of view of this computation, this is decoherent, because you do something which you are not supposed to do in this computation.
The large spin of the classical.
Yeah? No, and large spin, yeah.
I can see why Lloyd spin is not classical.
No, but even involvement of, say, third excited state will be already fatal. And what I want to tell is that, that when people speak about decoherence, in fact, it's combination, decoherence, I mean the exponential decay in time of these oscillations, it's combination of many quite different phenomena. It can be really inelastic dephasing, which is caused by some thermal fluctuations of the environment, either quantum or classical, depending on which frequency range you are probing. It can be, if we are dealing with system that requires some excitation during these manipulations, you have to take into account spontaneous relaxation from excited state to low energy state with some emission of some excitations in the environment. But at the same time, you can have gate errors. For instance, if your pulse generator is not really absolutely exact, or if you have, which works in the same way, very slow fluctuations of background charge or something like that. In addition to that, if you have a system which is more complicated than just simple two-level systems, you have leakage. For instance, if you have even weak interaction between spins, this weak interaction already can cause some kind of decoherence. So what I want to emphasize is that it's probably worthwhile to separate these two terms, reserve dephasing word for something really connected with quick and inelastic, and use decoherence as any apparent decay of useful signal, and then try to understand what is the main cause of the of this decoherence. And at least in this Japanese group experiment, it was clearly background charge on the level of gate errors that caused this decoherence. If you go to other experiments, say, made at Saclay by Michel Devaret group or at Delft, it's even less clear what kind of decoherence they measure. But in all cases, I think amount of leakage is pretty high. So maybe sooner or later, this will become the most dangerous problem, because getting pure two-level system is usually very complicated. Now, just to finish with a few words about inelastic dephasing, and then I will probably finish. So what I want to tell is that, say, in this experiment like weak localization, what you will have if you interact, say, with some environment with some excitations of the level, say, phonons or magnons or other electrons, if you, say, even end up with the same energy, but somewhere absorb energy omega and somewhere emit the same energy H omega, still the phase that you generated will depend on the time interval between these absorption and emission, and as a result, there will be the dephasing, and this dephasing will be possible to describe in terms of interaction of your system with some oscillator bus. And this is pretty generic description. You just need to know what is density of states of these oscillators, and you can calculate this dephasing rate. Now, the last thing I want to emphasize are what often people call dephasing, and what to my mind is not at all dephasing or decoherence, and just different phenomena. The most clear example is persistent current. So what you are supposed to do, you're supposed to take a ring, and if you will just put this ring into some magnetic field, you can have some magnetization, some current induced around the ring. But to make it this situation even more dramatic, you can imagine inserting magnetic flux through, so that classically there is no magnetic field in the ring, and still there will be some magnetization and some current along the ring, provided the energy of the ground state, or if you are at finite temperature, the free energy depends on this flux. And it does because of all kind of quantum mechanical quantization. So this phenomena can be made completely quantum, and it looks like anything that actually changes the amplitude of this magnetization, changes the amplitude of persistent current, is dephasing. But at the same time, when you think a bit more, you realize that, of course, if you turn on the interaction, say, between electrons, this interaction will change your energy and will change the way how energy depends on phi. But why, how can you call the ground state property dephasing? I actually don't understand. Now, another even more common mistake is connected with a set of phenomena which are called orthogonality catastrophe or Caldera-Leggett type of phenomena, where you are considering some tunneling of a system from one state to another, and take into account interaction between your system and the environment. And it was probably Anderson who long ago claimed that certain processes in Fermi gases can be locked by the orthogonality, basically because if you are studying tunneling, say, of a particle from one minima to another, you can calculate the tunneling probability. But if you couple this particle with fermions, for instance, if it happens in a metal, then this tunneling probability will be much smaller, because you have to involve into this tunneling phenomena not only particle itself, but the rest of the environment, which should adjust its wave functions and change them accordingly to the change of this position of this heavy particle. And there is huge literature about that. Matthew is a big expert in this. But what I want to tell is that you, in principle, can study the splitting of two quantum states. And then, of course, if you take into account interaction with the environment, you will find that this splitting is suppressed, or maybe even vanishes, because of this orthogonality catastrophe. But the question whether it is dephasing or not is, for me, quite clear. I don't think at all that having actually exact, well-determined quantum states, you can speak about defacing. And typical mistake that is done in this connection is that what people try to have, they try to have their quantum system described by some wave function and then turn on interaction between this system and the environment.
What's that difference with the Cooper-Bear box when you start with your, I don't know what it was in the Fermi gas, some heavy particle, something one well, and you let it oscillate, and you know,
what this phenomenon will determine is magnitude of the Josephson coupling. It will not actually decay the oscillations.
They will. I mean, it depends a bit on what the experiment is, but if you start in one well and then lower the barrier and it's oscillating, those oscillations will decay during the coupling.
You have these two levels, and you have certain splitting. Now, everything is, of course, period of the oscillation is determined by the splitting, but the time decay of them is not determined by the splitting. So, if you take into account this suppression of the tunneling by the interaction, all these zero bias anomalies, whatever, you will not see it as a decay of the oscillation. You will see it as some modification of the period.
Yeah, and that's, when it's very weak coupling to the environment, the period doesn't change much with the decays, and when you make it strong enough. Okay, you're just distinguishing when the splitting, for example, gets driven to zero, you don't want to think about it as dephasing.
It's usually
an over damped and under damped.
No, right. And the only thing I want to emphasize that you should have to be very careful in separating these two things. Damping is
negative. Different than the
yeah. Normalized. Yeah. So real processes and virtual processes act different. And just a couple of remarks, and I'm finishing. So what actually you have instead of your quantum system with certain state and environment, you usually have two quantum systems. And it's not even correct that you can separate them and write wave function for one and for another. What you have total wave function. And if you're interested in states near the ground state, these states are not at all direct product of some state of one system and some state of another system. This direct product is not even eigenstate of the system. So if you will create, on paper of course, because experimentally it's very difficult to do that, if you will create this state and then ask yourself how it involves in time, you can get indeed a lot of time evolution, but this will not at all be anything close to the deface. Okay, I think I was already speaking for too long, and if there still are any questions, I will be happy to answer.
So let's thank Boris very much. Thank you. We've had a number of questions, but we have a little time for some more. Is there a simple origin for this factor of four between the two?
No, I don't know. I think it's indeed, in this particular setup, it's indeed the higher pay for gate error if you shoot on this point where both states are unstable, rather than shooting in the point where only one of them is unstable, because you can, in a sense, have both mistakes are fatal if you are studying these coupled qubits rather than each qubit separately. And I still haven't understood how to write it convincingly, but on hand waving level, I think it's the answer.
Does that suggest some kind of scaling law at the end gates that the time would go like 1/n².
No, if it would be like that, then forget it. Then forget it. And that's why I think things like gate errors and leakage should be eliminated much more seriously. Whether it's possible in principle, it's another thing. But
but if you are fighting some kind of scaling like that, it's a hopeless battle, right?
The only nice thing is that you usually don't, there are no operations, at least, I mean, I'm not a big expert in quantum computation, but as far as I understand, there are no operations that they want which involve simultaneously many spins. You, each time you operate with only two. So it means that if you will be able to effectively separate the rest of your quantum computer from two qubits that operate at...
You know, a big quantum computer is just going to be a superposition.
Yeah. So each operation is local.
Yeah.
But still it's dangerous because, as I told, you have to separate it very efficiently because even very small leakage will be fatal.
They're amazing new experiments, and it's great to hear about them. And the theoretical story, obviously developed in the last 10, 20 years, is also pretty incredible. But it would be nice for you to maybe just emphasize where you think the sort of open and future conceptual theoretical issues are in this field. I mean, I can see an enormous number of experimental challenges in manipulating these small quantum systems and trying to eliminate dephasing. But the question is, where is the main theoretical meat, in your view?
Well, it's a good question, and I mean, I would like somebody to give me some guidance here. But my feeling is that indeed, having experiments that are as new and bringing something that people would call hopeless even to think about several years ago, like, reliably measuring, high frequency responses on many signals and so on. From the theoretical point of view, I think we are now on the same stage as people who were in the 60s, having basically Boltzmann equation and tau approximation and trying to explain all phenomena in solids by, this weapon. So very soon we will learn limits of these approaches that we have developed up to now to these much more complicated things. And then I think, or I hope,
so at some point the experiments will become sufficiently refined that we can start seeing the breakdown of our toy pictures of decoherence. Is that kind of...
Yeah. So what I want to tell is that now we're allowed to ask much more sophisticated questions that we were allowed several years ago. Mm-hmm. Whether the answers is possible to get based on what we know now, I hope not. I hope getting the answers would be also challenging. But right now we're on a stage when asking new questions is the main the main contribution that we. Excuse me. Well, you could come to experimentalist and propose certain measurements, and he will start laughing. I mean, and give you 100 reasons why you cannot even think about that. But look.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's maybe a question along the same lines as the last one. So on the web page for this program, in the description, it's written that there are several experiments on mesoscopics which involve non-equilibrium systems or something like that. So I wondered if you could give a full list of what you have in mind. Is it basically the experiments on qubits which you've described in this talk, or are there?
Yeah, I mean, those are definitely among the most interesting. I mean, I can start recalling other measurements in quantum dots. And there are reasons why small systems like mesoscopic systems, nanostructures, are even more driven out of equilibrium than bulk systems, namely because all traditional relaxation times, not only phase relaxation, but traditional relaxation times are also suppressed by discreteness of the spectrum. For instance, if you excite the electronic system in closed quantum dot, you cannot rely as easily on interaction between electrons for this relaxation, because you cannot satisfy conservation law. And at the same time, effect of phonons can be strongly suppressed, because phonon wavelengths can be even much bigger than the size of your system, and then the dipole matrix element will be very small. So there are reasons why even small perturbations will drive these systems out of equilibrium much more efficiently than bulk systems. Now, whether anything is flashing right now, there are indeed several questions to address, but I mean, giving full list right now, I think, would be too much of, you know, burden for me. I mean, we're here expecting a number of experimentalists, and I think each of them has some smoking gun in the pocket. But I personally want, as a result of this program, understand more what are the problems in the field.
You mentioned in several sources of noise, but I mean, when you were speaking, I was thinking that many of them are actually very easily checkable. I mean, for example, the influence of the pulses, I mean, can be easily checked by changing the amplitude of the pulse at the input gate, I mean, and then to study systematically. The same way can be done by studying, for example, the influence of one direct noise of the system. I mean, that would be eventually, in some graph, there were never ever bugs on the points. I mean, so.
Where?
Yeah. For example, you mentioned that in Borja, without in a very noisy environment, and you mentioned that would be important. I mean, without ever bugs, I don't know how much important it is.
Here. As far as I understand, it's indeed of the size of each point.
Okay.
On the other hand, as I told, it was not really easy to engage experimentalists in discussion of this. At the same time, I repeat, each point is a result of a very large number of measurements and averaging over them. But you see, this is clear proof. This is clear proof that this is not that it's something like 1/f noise, because the dependence is not linear in time as it would be for any relaxation rate. Now, getting more into that definitely is possible. The slight problem is that people are excited in, you know, in competition. Who will first make 2 qubits? Who will first make 3 qubits? Who will make time longer? I hope that these systematical studies, which indeed is possible to do, in spite of the fact that, I mean, it's not easy, because each part of this is unique for that lab, for instance, and other people would, you know, refuse to. But there is a number of groups, and I think that we will get enough information. So it's not completely beyond understanding. It just had not been done.
Let's thank Boris one more time.